So we're recording this additional segment about protesters and frequently asked questions about people that want to protest. They want to do it in a legal way. They want to know what their rights are. They want to know what the best way is to go about it. So we're going to do this segment. It's going to be at the beginning of the podcast. Hopefully this will help you understand what your rights are in a process and for a cause that you want to protest or legally assemble for. So Dad, let's start out just by talking about what are someone's rights as a protester.
Your protest cannot be blocked because of content. For instance, the March on Washington in 1963, the content was civil rights. The March for Our Lives, which is a demonstration in 2018, content, gun control. Those can't be blocked.
Right. When it's no matter what the content is, if it's, you know, something now like racism in America and that's what you're assembling for or that's what you're protesting for, that content is fine. Just like the, you know, content in the past that we either have described or will describe in the case law, that content is protected.
But we draw a line between content and violence or destruction of private property. That is not protected by the First Amendment. And that, if you are a protester, you make sure that you avoid those things so that you stay protected and you stay within the confines of the First Amendment.
You don't want to give any law enforcement or anybody an excuse or a reason to arrest you or charge you with something that's going to stick. And if you do destroy property or cause violence, then that does give them an excuse to arrest you, which, you know, obviously we're all trying to avoid in these situations. So another question is, where can you and can't you protest?
Normally, you're protected if you're on public property, like a sidewalk, a park, a street, any kind of a public forum. Those areas are protected areas, and you can protest in those areas. Where you have to be careful is private property. If the private property is not something that's normally used for the public, or around government buildings or businesses, because you cannot block the lawful operation of a government office or of a business. So if you're protesting on the sidewalk, people still have to be able to get into the business, and you can't block the entrance to the business.
Okay, can police or local leaders tell you to go home, tell you to disperse?
Well, you know, an example is, we see it a lot. A mayor shows up and says, please go home. Well, that doesn't have the effect of law. You don't have to go anywhere. But we have also seen curfews, which are laws established between this time and this time you can't be on the street. If you break those laws, you can be arrested for those, because those laws are designed to protect safety.
Okay, what about recording? What are you allowed to record? What can and can't you record? Can you record law enforcement activity during these protests? How do you deal with that?
A lot of this has to do with the state you're in. For instance, in Florida, you cannot record somebody's voice unless they give you permission. So a lot of times you do videotape, you're hearing somebody else who you don't have permission on the videotape.
That's not actually correct. You can absolutely record people in public if they know you're recording them, then you don't have to get their permission.
If they know you're recording.
Right. Right. Which you have your phone out and you say, I'm recording you right
yes.
now. You don't have to get their permission if
because
it's public.
They know. Because there's a tacit waiver if you know someone's recording you and you still talk.
Correct.
But in Florida, we do have the
right.
two-party
you can't
rule.
You can't secretly record a conversation. That's what you meant.
Right.
But I'm talking about in these protests, cops are arresting someone, you know, unlawfully for just sitting there and using their free speech, and you're recording that officer doing that. Can you do that?
Yes. And there's another issue, too, is it a public place?
Right.
And if it's out in the public, then pictures, again, not talking about voice, but there's nowhere where pictures are prohibited. If you're in the public, you can take all the pictures you want.
You can also take all the recordings you want if you're in public.
If
you
the
can
person
record,
knows.
Well,
now,
if they're in public, but hold on. You waive your right to privacy if you do something in public on the streets. That's absolutely true. You waive your right to privacy. You can get, if you're doing something public or you're posting something on Facebook, recording your picture, whatever it is, you waive your right to privacy.
So let's say I'm having a private conversation with Joe over here and somebody walks up and secretly records it. You're saying that's okay?
No. But I'm saying if you're in a rally and the cops are arresting somebody for just kneeling or doing whatever, you're allowed to record that. There's
yes.
nothing unlawful about recording that. Yes, all the time, bright line rule. You should never record people without their knowledge, okay? That's absolutely a bright line rule. But I think, you know, you turning on your phone and recording something that's happening in a protest that you don't agree with, it might not hurt you just in the background say, I'm recording you, but you can record, you know, that police activity or whatever. Now, the question can also be reversed. Can someone record you if you're out there in public, and can they take pictures of you? And what can you do to be to not be photographed or recorded?
If you're out in public, especially photographs and video, you really don't have any protections.
Right.
All those photos
are... It's going to be hard to argue that you didn't want anybody to see what you were doing when you're doing it out in public. That's the point. If you choose to do something out in the streets, like throw a brick through a window or whatever, and someone records you doing that, you're not going to have a good argument to right to privacy because you're out in public.
And they even have a right to use that image later on. Like we see them on news reports or, you know, all those things. So you really can't protect your image if you're out there in public doing a protest.
All right, next question. What can and can't a police officer do during a protest?
Well, the police officers, the key is they're really there initially to protect you as a protester, to protect your right to protest. So that's their initial reason for being there. And that's what they should be doing if you're doing a lawful protest. However, violence, destruction of property, they have a right to keep the citizens safe. And that's their job. And if you break out of the normal protest mode and do something destructive, then they're going to do what they're supposed to do, and that is protect the public.
Right. They can't incite violence themselves as police officers and come fight with the crowd, but they are allowed to use force to stop violence, stop destruction of property, stop fights, things like that from happening.
They also, if they come up to you and they say, I want your phone, or I want that piece of property or this piece of property, you do not have to give them your phone unless they have a search warrant, which is signed by a judge.
Or unless they're arresting you.
Right.
They can take your phone. Yeah. But I mean, at that point, they better have something or else they're going to be screwed. If they're arresting you for one of these disorderly conduct or something that's not going to stick, then whatever they do find in your phone, and you know, that opens up a whole can of worms. But if you're being arrested, they can take your phone, obviously. But if they just ask you for your phone, you can absolutely say no to that.
Right. And if you are being arrested, key is to stay calm and don't resist, because that's another crime, to resist arrest, even resist arrest without violence. So stay calm, do what the police officer says, and everything will go better for you.
Okay. And then one of the last questions is, can you get fired for showing up at a protest?
Well, it all depends on what your job is, what your job agreement. If you're supposed to be at work that day and you don't show up for work because you go to a protest, you can be fired.
It's not like a federal holiday or something like that.
No, and you can't decide on your own that you're just not going to show up for work. You can be fired for going to a protest.
Right, but you shouldn't. This is something you should call a lawyer about, to talk about what the specifics are surrounding your termination, because, you know, if they fire you because of your race or because you're supporting a minority race or something like that, then absolutely that's going to be an unlawful termination. So it really depends on your specific situation. But yeah, if you just don't show up to work or you do something that violates your contract at these protests, like you get arrested or something like that for throwing a brick through a window, then you're probably going to be able to be terminated as well at work. So that concludes the frequently asked questions segment of this. And now we're going to get to the rest of the podcast. Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And to be true to our name, we are going to talk about the current event today. We're going to talk about the protests and the rallies and the riots that are surrounding the racism in our country and the people fighting against that racism. And we're getting a lot of questions, and we're going to handle it from a lawyerly perspective and a legal angle, because most of the questions we're getting are surrounded around these protests and these rallies. People are asking, are these rallies legal? Are these riots legal? What makes them legal and what doesn't? So we're going to tackle the constitutional law issue of the First Amendment, and we're going to focus on the freedom of speech and the right to assemble. What's funny about constitutional law is it is a first year law school class. So it's something we learn right when we start law school. And it's a class that I can remember more than any other class just about. My professor was Professor Seidenfeld. And one day, using the Socratic method, which is just they call on students, ask for answers. And if you don't know the answer, you get embarrassed, basically. And he asked me a question. I was not paying attention at all. I answered it as best as I could with a guess while looking at my outline, following along, because I knew what pages we were supposed to read before that class. My answer was completely wrong, answering another case. Everybody starts laughing at me. It was all in good fun. I didn't care. The professor, you know, gave me a little ripping in the class and then moved on. But what's also funny about that class is it is the only class in law school that I got the book award for, which means the highest grade on the class. The end of the year exam is what the full grade is based off of, and I got the highest grade there. So some could say I had the last laugh. It also doesn't have a ton to do with what I practice in personal injury law, constitutional law. There's not a lot of crossover there, but in today's subject, in today what we're talking about, there's a lot of crossover. So my dad and I are going to take this kind of like a law school class. We're going to go through some of the cases that set the precedent about what is allowed under free speech, what isn't, what's allowed under the right to assemble, and what isn't. And we're going to kind of just dive through it methodically, go through some of the court cases, and do our best to apply it to today's situation. Hopefully you guys enjoy this podcast. We are going to have more on the George Floyd situation. We are going to talk about the criminal charges that were brought against the cops that murdered him. We're going to talk about what those charges mean, why they were charged a certain way, why the charges were increased. And we'll dive into that. I'll have my dad on that podcast as well to tackle the criminal issues. But for now, enjoy the show. Welcome back to another episode of Peter's Proffer here in the courtroom of current events. And to be true to our name, we are going to talk about the current event today. We're going to talk about the protests and the rallies and the riots that are surrounding the racism in our country and the people fighting against that racism. And we're getting a lot of questions, and we're going to handle it from a lawyerly perspective and a legal angle, because most of the questions we're getting are surrounded around these protests and these rallies. People are asking, are these rallies legal? Are these riots legal? What makes them legal and what doesn't? So we're going to tackle the constitutional law issue of the First Amendment, and we're going to focus on the freedom of speech and the right to assemble. What's funny about constitutional law is it is a first-year law school class, so it's something we learn right when we start law school, and it's a class that I can remember more than any other class just about. My professor was Professor Seidenfeld, and one day, using the Socratic method, which is just they call on students, ask for answers, and if you don't know the answer, you get embarrassed, basically, and he asked me a question. I was not paying attention at all. I answered it as best as I could with a guess while looking at my outline, following along because I knew what pages we were supposed to read before that class. My answer was completely wrong, answering another case. Everybody starts laughing at me. It was all in good fun. I didn't care. The professor, you know, gave me a little ripping in the class and then moved on. But what's also funny about that class is it is the only class in law school that I got the book award for, which means the highest grade on the class. The end of the year exam is what the full grade is based off of, and I got the highest grade there. So some could say I had the last laugh. It also doesn't have a ton to do with what I practice in personal injury law, constitutional law. There's not a lot of crossover there, but in today's subject, in today what we're talking about, there's a lot of crossover. So my dad and I are going to take this kind of like a law school class. We're going to go through some of the cases that set the precedent about what is allowed under free speech, what isn't, what's allowed under the right to assemble, and what isn't. And we're going to kind of just dive through it methodically, go through some of the court cases, and do our best to apply it to today's situation. Hopefully you guys enjoy this podcast. We are going to have more on the George Floyd situation. We are going to talk about the criminal charges that were brought against the cops that murdered him. We're going to talk about what those charges mean, why they were charged a certain way, why the charges were increased. And we'll dive into that. I'll have my dad on that podcast as well to tackle the criminal issues. But for now, enjoy the show. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So that is the First Amendment. And today we are going to focus on the freedom of speech and the right to assemble. So, Dad, before we get into kind of how American law has shaped what this First Amendment actually means, why don't you give us a little bit of history of how we got the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights?
Well, it starts like most all of our laws start. If you go back to England, when people used to petition the king for problems they had, like they want Scotland to be free, if the king didn't like their petition, he'd just lop off their heads. So they didn't have a right to petition. But then the Magna Carta, like so many other freedoms that we have, back in 1215, established the first right to petition. Then later on, the House of Commons passed a law saying someone could not be punished for petitioning the king for anything. So then they had freedom to petition and freedom to come to the governmental authorities. Then when we wrote our Constitution, it didn't have the Bill of Rights when it was first passed. But the states that felt the federal government was too powerful said we need to have some rights to protect the individual. So then we had the Bill of Rights, and that wasn't passed until 1791. So the first 10 amendments are what we refer to as the Bill of Rights, and that was designed to protect individual freedom.
And you look around, and there's still some countries today, like China, for instance, that don't have free speech, and they're censored on the computer, on Twitter, on, you know, through their emails, what they can say publicly. In the past, there have been regimes that have stuffed out free speech, and, you know, it's shining more brightly than ever how important free speech is and how we need it. And we'll go through some of the cases that really explain how even sometimes if you don't agree with someone's free speech, it's still important that it is legal and allowed for them to be able to express those ideas.
Well just to show you, this really didn't become important, this First Amendment, until around 1830, when a lot of people were petitioning Congress to abolish slavery. That was really the first big mass of petitions to Congress. Congress even passed a law saying no one could petition Congress anymore to get rid of slavery. Luckily, that law was changed about 5 years later when John Quincy Adams introduced the legislation. But then it started to become more and more popular to petition. There was a thing called the bonus petitions, where first World War veterans wanted a bonus, and they petitioned, and they came and sat in all the parks in Washington, D.C. Well, they called out the troops, believe it or not. They burned all those camps and chased them out of Washington. So it had a kind of a rough start initially.
And just generally speaking about free speech and how it's handled generally in our Constitution, in our governmental system, the Supreme Court requires the government to provide substantial justification for the interference with the right of free speech where it attempts to regulate the content of the speech. Generally, a person cannot be held liable either criminally or civilly for anything written or spoken about a person or a topic so long as it's truthful and based on an honest opinion on such statements. So again, that's we've talked about libel and slander before and how one of the elements of libel and slander, because it does say you can't be civilly liable, is it has to be truthful. In libel and slander, if whatever the remarks are against you are truthful, that's an affirmative defense and it's not libel, it's not slander because of the First Amendment, because of free speech. So sometimes people don't think about it that way, but that's why they have that as an element of libel and slander. The Supreme Court also recognized that the government may prohibit some speech that may cause a breach of the peace or cause violence. So some unprotected or less protected categories of speech are advocacy of illegal action, fighting words, commercial speech, and obscenity. The big difficulty with this section and talking about what speech can be restricted is defining these words. What is obscene speech? What are fighting words? And there are some cases throughout history that kind of explain that. But in law school, especially like us getting through what this actually is and how it gets litigated and how the Supreme Court will make one decision and then a year later they'll overturn that decision. So to start out and talk a little bit about what obscene speech is, we'll take it to the case of Miller versus California, which is a 1973 case. In this case, the Supreme Court mapped out kind of a three-part definition of what obscenity is. First, the average person applying contemporary community standards must find that the work taken as a whole appeals to the purient interests. Second, that it depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct as defined by state law. And third, that the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. So this is, again, after years and years of litigating what obscene speech is. And speech can be in many mediums. It can be online. It can be print. It can be pictures. It can be, you know, vocal, verbal. So when they go through all this litigation, that's the best definition they can come up with for what's obscenity.
Of course, you've got Potter Stewart, and I don't know if it was in that case or another case, when he goes, when they asked him what is obscenity or what is obscene, he says, I know it when I see it. So that's the best he could do, and he was a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, no, this was after that. But yeah. And that's the point, is they try to define it as best they can, but it's still, like, to the person that's making obscene speech, maybe it's not obscene to them, but it's kind of a reasonable person standard, just like it is in everything else. And, you know, as we get to the cases later, I can't remember what year it was, but let me see if I can find this here real quick.
Schenck?
No. Talking about how, yeah, it was 1982, which was a lot later than I thought. The Supreme Court actually had to rule in New York versus Ferber that child pornography is not protected by the First Amendment and is obscene speech. So they actually had to litigate that issue, as you can understand how that seems crazy to us today, as to whether or not that's obscene speech. And that came after the 1973 case that defined obscenity.
Okay, next we should move to fighting words. The first case, or the key case on that, that's Szaplinski case. And in that case, the court said that words by their very utterance inflict injury or tend to incite an immediate breach of peace. In that case, the court had to balance. Yes, there might be some social value to what the people are saying, but that social value is outweighed by the interest of order and morality. So there's a weight, there's a balancing test sometimes in whether or not something is or isn't a fighting word that can be restricted.
And in 1949, the Terman Yellow case, where the U.S. Supreme Court limits the scope of the fighting words doctrine. They say that it's a function of the free speech to invite dispute, but it may be best served if its high purpose induces a condition of unrest, creating dissatisfaction with the conditions as they are, or even stirs the people to anger. So it even kind of expanded what can be considered fighting words. But again, that's kind of the best we have in defining it, which isn't great. And, you know, whether or not something incites violence is very vague and has been argued about for years and years and years, and we'll continue to argue about it in the future. Okay, we're going to do our best not to make this a four-hour podcast, but we do want to kind of go through, kind of like simulating a law school class, and talk about how we look at speech, how we figure out, or how the Supreme Court has figured out whether or not something's unlawful speech. And Dad, we'll start with the Schenck case.
Well, the Schenck case is an interesting case. It's 1919. That date's important because of what follows the Schenck case and how many things followed it, the problems that occurred in this country after 1919. But in that case, we have someone during World War I that actually told people not to sign up for the draft. Okay, so that meant they were interfering with the lawful function of government, having people not sign up for the draft, which affected our national security. In that case, they found that was not protected speech because it affected the national security. And that started kind of a series of cases that didn't have protected speech, but that started the standard of what was or wasn't going to be protected speech. And after that, in the 20s, we had the KKK rallies, where obviously, you know, nobody likes what they have to say, but it was protected speech because it did not interfere with the national security or governmental function. It was just content.
And as we go through these cases, you'll see there's more bad than good that's really protected. There's a lot of communist thought, a lot of KKK, a lot of racist speech that's protected under free speech. But there is some good that came from this free speech being exercised and the right to assemble. And the Schenck case also created the standard clear and present danger, which we've all heard in movies and other things, but that's kind of where it came from, is does this speech create clear and present danger? And they said that it did in that case. There were other similar cases that happened around the 1920s where they had to determine whether or not someone interfering with the draft, interfering with the war, doing things that, you know, incited fights and anger and angst in the country. But we're going to jump ahead a little bit to 1940. Thornhill versus Alabama. The United States Supreme Court strikes down an Alabama law prohibiting loitering and picketing without a just cause or legal excuse near businesses. The court writes that the freedom of speech and the free press guaranteed by the Constitution embraces at the least the liberty to discuss publicly and truthfully all matters of public concern without previous restraint or fear of subsequent punishment. So Alabama had a law where you're not allowed to do this, and the Supreme Court struck it down, saying that people are allowed to go out and picket and talk about and explain why they disagree with, you know, whatever's going on in the world, as long as there is some kind of just cause or legal excuse.
The next case, and again, in the 40s as well, is the Minersville case. And that's where some Jehovah's Witnesses refused to salute the flag. And there was a law saying they had to salute the flag. So they challenged that law based on First Amendment grounds. Well, they lost. And in 1940, Justice Frankfurter, which is surprising that he wrote this decision, frankly, he's one of the most liberal judges out there. He wrote an opinion saying that it could in fact be enforced, that these children could in fact be expelled from school because they didn't salute the flag. Now, 3 years later, what happens? This is very rare that this kind of thing happens in the Supreme Court, because they like to rely on precedent, which means their prior rulings. They overruled that. They overruled themselves 3 years later in the West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, where they said that saluting the flag, if you don't want to salute the flag, that's fine, because that's your free speech, First Amendment right to not salute the flag. So they totally reversed their decision.
And that's just 70 or 80 years ago, where not saluting the flag was okay to be illegal. And think about how different it is today for people to be able to express themselves in that way if they want to, or other ways. Then we move into the 50s and Dennis versus the United States. The United States Supreme Court upholds the conviction of 12 Communist Party members convicted under the Smith Act of 1940. The court finds that the Smith Act, a measure banning speech which advocates the violent overthrow of the federal government, does not violate the First Amendment. So you are allowed to put into place laws that prevent people from speaking about violently overthrowing the government, because that is obviously fighting words.
Now, then we come to 1959, and a lot of history people, not as old as I am, remember the MacArthur eras, where Senator Joe MacArthur was going after people for being communists, and going after people in the media and actors, and subpoenaing them in and requiring them to give names of people they knew were other communists. And it would go on and on and on. And he was just horrible, a horrible example of the American politic. And there's a case that came out, Barenblatt. And this was the House Un-American Activities Committee. And he was a college professor. And they subpoenaed him, and he refused to answer the questions based on his First Amendment grounds. And the court concluded that a valid interrogation by the legislature for a valid legislative purpose is not protected speech. And he could be forced to say those things, to say the things and answer the questions. Today, I don't know whether the decision would be the same, frankly, but back then, because of all the communist hysteria, I think that had an effect on the decision.
In 1969, like we've already mentioned, Brandenburg versus Ohio, leader of the Ku Klux Klan, is convicted under Ohio law and sentenced to prison, primarily on the basis of speeches that he made at a Klan rally. The United States Supreme Court unanimously rules that speech advocating the use of force or crime is not protected if the advocacy is directed to incite or produce imminent lawless action, and the advocacy is also likely to incite or produce such action. So that law was upheld. And in 1971, we have Cohen versus California.
And I remember, you know, I was in college in 71, and this was a great case for people in college, because it meant you could wear anything on your t-shirt you wanted at any time, going to class, walking into the president of the university's office, because it said that F the draft, that t-shirt worn in a courthouse?
Jacket. He wore a jacket that said F the draft. Most people know this case.
Yeah, that's protected speech.
Right, the court concluded that was okay, and profane speech is actually protected by the First Amendment. By the First Amendment. In 1978, the Illinois Supreme Court rules that NASPA versus Skokie, that the National Socialist Party of America, a neo-Nazi group, can march throughout Skokie, a community inhabited by a number of Holocaust survivors. So as horrible and terrible as that is, and how miserable That is, it's actually free speech, and it was allowed.
It was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood in Skokie that they walked through, and I remember seeing pictures of it, and it was awful. They were walking through with swastikas as they were walking down the middle.
And you think about the causes that people have rallied for in the past, and it's just kind of sickening. But you know, that's what kind of comes with the free speech that we allow in our country, and that we still allow today. So, what's the next case?
All right, the next case is the we talked about the child pornography not being protected.
Right. So then one of the big ones in 1990, Texas versus Johnson, is one of a series of flag-burning cases. There were statutes that said it was illegal to burn flags, and originally it was upheld all the way up to the Supreme Court, but they reversed the Texas court's decision that this guy Johnson broke the law by desecrating the flag. And they invalidated statutes in 47 other states. So that's 48 states total had statutes prohibiting flag burning in 1990. And they were all invalidated by the Supreme Court. A bedrock principle underlying the First Amendment is that the government may not prohibit the expression of an idea simply because society finds the idea itself offensive or disagreeable. And the last case we're going to kind of address on free speech is RAV versus St. Paul, which is a Minnesota case that dealt with hate speech, and the statute in Minnesota banned certain kinds of hate speech, such as burning crosses or swastikas that might anger, alarm, or cause resentment in other bases of race, color, religion, or gender. And the reason it was struck down is because it wasn't banned equally among all sorts of ways that you can basically cause hate speech. It did not include political affiliation or sexual orientation. That hate speech would be permissible. So basically it's because it was unfairly applied to only certain groups and not all groups across the board. And now we'll jump over into the right to assemble, which allows people to gather for peaceful and lawful purposes. In 1937, we have the DeJong versus Oregon case, where the United States Supreme Court reverses the conviction of an individual under a state criminal statute for participating in a Communist Party political meeting. The court writes that the peaceable assembly for lawful discussion cannot be made a crime, and the holding of meetings for peaceable political action cannot be prescribed.
The next case is the NAACP versus Alabama. And in that case, Alabama ordered the NAACP to turn over all of their records, including their membership list. And they appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court because they felt like their members had a right to associate with each other and to associate with each other in private, that it shouldn't become a public matter. I think that back then we can see why they wanted those membership lists. Well, the Supreme Court recognized that and said that the freedom to associate and the freedom of privacy in one's associations was part of the freedom of assembly. And so they protected the membership list, and they protected their records.
The next case is Edwards versus South Carolina in 1962. 187 black students marched from Zion Baptist Church to the South Carolina State House, where they were arrested and convicted of breaching the peace. The Supreme Court ruled in an 8-1 decision to reverse the convictions, arguing that the state infringed on the free speech, free assembly, and freedom to petition of the students. So that was overturned because, very clearly, the right to peaceable assembly and the right to free speech, presenting someone's ideas and differences, whatever it may be, is absolutely protected by the First Amendment. So one of the issues with the First Amendment is that there are laws in place, especially criminal laws, that are used oftentimes. You see some videos posted on social media. You see it in this Edwards case. These vague, minor criminal laws are used to try to punish people for assembling and using their free speech. And those laws are things like disturbing the peace, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest without violence, trespass. Why do you think that is? Why do you think they try to use these laws to stifle people's free speech? And most of the time they don't stick.
Even if they don't stick, they get them off the street, they figure. They're going to lock them up. And therefore, they'll calm other people down because people don't want to be arrested. People don't want to go to jail, even though all the charges may be dropped. We have seen over and over again, in fact, the courts have ruled over and over again, that if you interpret these statutes to limit content, then the statutes are unconstitutional. The only way, for instance, disorderly conduct in Florida, it was declared unconstitutional unless there was an action that went along with the content. And so that's what's happened. For instance, if you kicked a police car, all right, so you could be arrested for disorderly conduct for that. But if you stood next to a police car and cussed at it, you couldn't get arrested for that because then you'd be arrested for content. So the courts over and over again in interpreting how statutes are applied made sure they're applied to just more than just the content.
So that is basically all we have for our law school class on the First Amendment. A lot of cases have interpreted this different ways. There's a lot of vague words used in interpreting what's free speech and what can be regulated. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this little kind of different episode, and we'll be back with you next time. On that midnight train.